Okay, thank you, everybody. Yeah, so I'm Dr. Michael Yeadon. I'm a career R&D specialist. I have a PhD and biological degrees, so biochemistry, toxicology, pharmacology. I led respiratory research for new drugs in a number of companies, but longest time was at Pfizer, where I was in charge of wide research in respiratory. I left 10 years ago, so although people often refer to me as that former Pfizer guy, my comments have absolutely nothing to do with my previous work. I'm just going to use or share certain perspectives. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing this solely because we have been lied to and misled very badly by our leaders and by the advisors that provide scientific advice to the UK government and probably in other countries as well. As to exactly why they're doing that, that's for when people ask me, when I say that there are things that are going on that are definitely wrong and have malign consequences, they often won't listen to me. They say, well, why is that happening? And I point out to them that if I were to witness a violent crime in the street from my window, and I could see it happening, and I phoned the police, and I was describing what was happening, and there was no question that if you believe me, there is this crime, the police wouldn't say, now wait, until you can tell me the motive for that crime you're witnessing, I'm not going to listen to you. It's just absurd, isn't it? Of course, I don't know why this wrongdoing is going on. I really... locked on... inaccuracies and untrustworthiness of PCR mass testing in the UK. And I think I've been vindicated in that it has been acknowledged that they were using too great an amplification, too low a specificity. Lots of the so-called positive results were, it's been used to frighten people and maintain the rationale for restrictions. I'm going to tell you about two things today. One is some insights I and others have had about the safety risks with the vaccines that are currently being administered to, I guess, hundreds of millions of people. And what I'm going to tell you, I think, should shock those of you who are thinking of having it for non-medical reasons. You know, perhaps something as trivial as going to a beach holiday. Shame on you. But I'm hoping what I'm going to tell you is going to provide sufficient concern. Another thing I'm going to tell you about in this year's lies are related to virus variants, the potential to escape immunity, the need for, the alleged need for top-up vaccines, and the fact that those vaccines are going to bypass regulatory examination. So what I'll say to you on that side is, you should anticipate your genetic sequences going from the whiteboards of pharmaceutical companies directly into the arms of hundreds of millions of people. So if they were good actors, you and I, we already have established there are some very bad actors in this. And so if you wanted to bring about serious injuries and deaths to a significant proportion of the world's population without it being obvious what you're doing, that's the way they could do it. So let me just take a step back and talk about the vaccines. So all of the lead vaccines are the ones that are being used at the AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Moderna. Although they use slightly different technical body, convert and turn into a piece of the virus, which I think people assumed would be inert, called the spike protein. Now, the spike protein, unfortunately, is not just a sort of inert docking protein. So we all have this cartoon vision in our mind of a ball covered in spikes, and those spikes, people understand, are what allows the virus to, as it were, stick to a cell, to a receptor, and then squirt the genetic information of the virus into the cell. So it's kind of intuitive and attractive that you would use those, because we would think, well, the spike can't infect you, that's true, can't give you the disease. That should be true. And it should immune response, educating the immune system so that if you see the wild type intact virus, you'll attack it. That all sounds sensible. And it was only about a month ago, I was just idly leafing through science like I do. Well, I'm pretty much retired now. Science has been my life. And I was just reading and I came across a gene of coronavirus spike proteins in both in test tubes and then in rodents. And I discovered to my horror that spike proteins are not just, as I say, passive anchor proteins to attach viruses to cells to allow them to infect cells. They're also biologically active. Spike proteins are fusogenic. They assist cells to clump one to another. They can also, I read a paper yesterday, that they can trigger the complement pathway. Now, complement is analogous to the sort of coagulation pathway. In fact, it has quite a lot of analogies, but fundamentally it's a rapid amplification system that the body uses ultimately to form what's called a membrane attack complex. So when the body discovers it's under attack, its complement system is activated and ultimately leads to a protein that drills a hole inside of a cell, kills independent of anything to do with the virus, is capable of initiating blood coagulation, activating cells, triggering the complement cascade. This is a very bad thing. You don't want to have that happen to you, and you shouldn't want it for anybody else. And yet, all of the vaccines currently work by giving rise, by inducing the body to produce copious amounts of this spike protein. Personally, I think it was just an arrogant mistake on the part of the designers, because it doesn't injure and kill that many people. But I do believe it is responsible for injury and death within hours and days to a very large number of people after vaccination. So those of us who've been concerned to see a temporal relationship between mass rollout of vaccination, for example, in countries like UK, all of its sub-nations and Israel, and has been followed by very large numbers of deaths, I don't think that that's a coincidence. And I'm not sold on the idea that the fundamental safety risk at the heart of all of these genetic vaccines. So having just laid out...
Mike, excuse me. Excuse me. This is a really bad line. Maybe we can improve it if you turn off the video. Yeah.
Yes.
That may help.
I've just done that.
Yeah. Let me quickly try and translate what you've said so far, and then maybe I can ask a couple of questions in those parts, with reference to those parts, which I don't think I understand fully because I understood fully because of the bad sound. But give me a chance to translate what you said. Also, Mike Eden hat nochmal erklärt, wo er herkommt, dass er Vizepräsident von Pfizer gewesen ist. Sein Leben war immer die Wissenschaft, und obwohl er jetzt quasi pensioniert ist, sagt er, ist er natürlich weiterhin im Thema. Er hat aber seit 10 Jahren nichts mehr mit Pfizer zu tun, sodass also all die Anwürfe, die gekommen sind, von wegen, ja, du bist ja einer von Pfizer, aus seiner Sicht und auch aus meiner Sicht vollständig ins Leere gehen. Er sagt, er weist darauf hin, dass wir hier in diesem letzten Jahr von unseren politischen und auch Wirtschaftsführern massiv getäuscht worden sind. Massiv getäuscht worden sind. Das sind Bad Actors, so nennt er sie. So nenne ich sie auch. Und er sagt, das ist offensichtlich. Warum die das machen, sagt er, darüber kann man im Moment nur spekulieren. Nur, wenn er eine Straftat, auf frischer Tat jemanden eine Straftat, eine massive Straftat begehen sieht von seinem Fenster aus und die Polizei ruft, dann fragt ihn die Polizei nicht danach, warum die das machen, sondern die gehen und ermitteln und sorgen dafür, dass diesem strafrechtlich relevanten Geschehen ein Ende gesetzt wird. Deswegen sagt er, über das Warum können wir lange nachdenken, aber jetzt geht es darum, dafür zu sorgen, dass das, was passiert, beendet wird, weil das, was passiert, sind schlimmste Straftaten, begangen durch Bad Actors, wie er sie nennt, also durch unsere eigene sogenannte politische Elite und durch die sogenannte, sich selbst so nennende Wirtschaftselite, Konzernelite. Und er sprach eben von dem berühmten Spike-Protein. Wir kennen ja alle das Bild, mit dem das Coronavirus dargestellt wird, so ein Ball mit ganz vielen Zacken dran, mit ganz vielen Spitzen dran. Dieses Spike-Protein, sagt er, sieht eigentlich so schlimm nicht aus. Es ist, wenn es andockt, und so scheint es ja zu sein, dass dieses Spike-Protein nur oder diese Spitzen nur dafür da sind, an die Zellen anzudocken und dann einzudringen. Er sagt, es sieht eigentlich so aus, als sei das alles. Aber das ist nicht alles, als ist kein bloß passives Protein, sondern es ist biologisch aktiv. Und da muss ich ihn jetzt fragen, weil ich das nicht komplett verstanden habe. Ich habe allerdings von Professor Hockerts und anderen, mit denen wir ja im regelmäßigen Austausch sind, auch schon gehört, dass dieses Spike-Protein das eigentliche Problem ist, insbesondere wenn es durch Impfungen sozusagen repliziert wird. Weil, und das ist das, bevor ich ihn frage, das ist das, was ich eben zum Schluss gehört habe, weil durch dieses, ich glaube, das war der Zytokinsturm, der dann einsetzt, beziehungsweise die ständige Replizierung, der Körper geht dann Autoimmunreaktion, der Körper geht quasi auf sich selbst los. Er sagt jedenfalls unterm Strich, bevor ich das jetzt gleich nochmal konkret abfrage, das ist verantwortlich nach Impfung, verantwortlich für eine Unmenge an Toten, für eine Unmenge an Menschen, die gestorben sind. Er verweist auf sowohl das Vereinigte Königreich, aber auch auf Israel, da haben wir jetzt gehört, 40 mal mehr Menschen in der Altersgruppe über 80 sind daran gestorben, nach Impfung gestorben, als vorher an Covid gestorben sind. Und ich glaube, 260 mal mehr unter den Jüngeren sind nach Impfung gestorben, mehr als vorher an Covid gestorben sind. Ähnliche Zahlen hören wir aber auch aus England und aus allen anderen Ländern. Okay, Mike, I think I got it, but please, because the sound was so bad, can you explain again from when you told us about how everybody thinks that the spike protein is just a passive protein, but in reality it does much more than just stick to the cell. And as it is biologically active, can you explain that one more time, please?
Yes, certainly. Yes, if it was just simply a passive anchor, it wouldn't need to have, I don't think, particularly complex. It would need to take a particular shape in three dimensions so that it would stick to something on the outside of the cell. The virus has adopted, shall we say, the ACE2 receptor, which is on the outside of many, many cells in the cardiopulmonary system. But it's actually a very, I don't know the full details, I think it's a trimeric structure. So it's in some sort of spiral. Protein, and although I'm not sure at a biochemical level exactly how it initiates coagulation and complement cascade, it's very demonstrable. I've seen experiments in which people have added different quantities of spike protein from other coronaviruses to primary human cells and demonstrated both pathway activation and sometimes the active clumping of cells. So it is capable of bringing about these sort of pathophysiological changes. And I will add, just for, I think it'll help people believe what I'm telling them. We know, don't we, that although this is, a respiratory virus, it's true that sometimes people die of non-respiratory problems. And the thing that often comes up is clots. You know, in fact, that's one of the characteristics of people who've died, now, I think, of COVID-19 rather than just with it incidentally, they demonstrate all the signs of sure, but that is entirely consonant with this idea that part of the pathology of the virus is that its spike proteins are not just passive anchors, but also active stimulators of various processes in the body. So I think people know that and have wondered, why is it that, unlike influenza, where this is not a common finding, with influenza, I understand people often die of like what's called a bacterial superinfection. They get bacterial pneumonia and die. But I think in the case of SARS-CoV-2 infection, COVID-19 disease, that one of the problems is it eventually causes derangement of what's called ventilation lung perfusion mismatch. So the blood and the air are no longer going to the right places. And so someone can end up with lower oxygen levels in their blood, and they're not even particularly aware of difficulties of breathing. So I think that will help people believe, why is it that that damn virus does these things? Well, I'm telling you that it seems likely to me it's consistent do some of the things that happen to people who are infected. So I think that's really, I think, what people need to know. And then the next thing, Rainer, and anyone who's listening, I hope you can hear me, that because all of the vaccines to date work by persuading, inducing your cells to manufacture spike protein, that's not a good thing for you. I don't know if you need to translate that, because I want to get onto the, why this really matters. It's not just some minor phenomenon in the label.
I'll translate that. Also weist nochmal darauf hin, dass dieses Spike-Protein nicht bloß ein passives Protein ist, was da sitzt und sich andockt, sondern es hat eine aktive biologische Struktur. Es setzt biologische Prozesse in Gang und sorgt insbesondere dafür, dass verschiedenste körperliche Funktionen in Chaos versetzt werden. Derangement of, also völlige Chaos bei den körperlichen Funktionen. Damit sind dann wohl die Organe gemeint, die zerstört werden. Das haben wir schon von verschiedenen Seiten gehört. Und jetzt wollte er auf die genauen Abläufe, die durch diese hier jetzt verwendeten sogenannten Impfstoffe verursacht werden, eingehen, auf diese mRNA-Impfstoffe. So I assume that you're going to explain now, Mike, what these vaccines, that mRNA, they're not really vaccines, we all know this, but what these mRNA injections actually do in your body.
Yes.
Could I ask a question?
Of course.
I have one question. So if this process is underway, like this, exaggerated immune or like the activity of the spike protein, is there anything, any remedy known that would stop that process? I mean, that you could maybe administer once, or would this be like a non-stop, that you have to take the medication in order to stop that process? Or is it basically, if it's, gone awry, is it then, is it over?
It's a very good question. It's a very good question.
Get it out of your body.
Or could you just stop the process? Yeah. You know, that there's something you can take and it stops the process, like cortisone would, does do that with like an allergic shock or something. But then you maybe have to take it all the time. So you're basically hooked on the medication.
I'm not a medical doctor, and I wouldn't want anyone to take what I would say as medical advice, because I'm not qualified to give it. But yes, I do. I am aware that there are some medicinal products, some in the pipeline of various companies, and there might be some approved that are complement inhibitors. So I was a responsible physician who's complying with their Hippocratic oath, having heard what's happened over the last few days in Europe, for example, heard from me why it's occurring. I think they should gather to the questioner's inquiry such materials as might oppose toxicological consequences. So if they should be alert to the possibility that complement is activated, alert to the possibility that changes in blood coagulation and clot lysis dismiss side effects as, you know, probably COVID itself and so on. I think there's a bit of that. I've heard physicians who work in emergency medicine who have witnessed colleagues, probably not on purpose, but they're just simply what's in front of them and are just interpreting certain presentations, people turning up unwell, as always caused by coronavirus, whereas as up to pathology of the virus, not its infection, but some of these spike protein-based pathologies, I do think they would look very similar. And so I urge responsible medics to be alert to that possibility and to the questioners inquiry to have access to tests and potential medicines that might halt that process. Mm-hmm. But here's what I want to tell you. I've worked in pharmaceutical R&D for over 30 years, and so it's been my pleasure and privilege to work in what Professor Sir James Black, a Nobel laureate who was responsible with others for inventing beta blockers and the H2N gastric acid antagonist, so a very clever person. And he made a famous statement once that pharmaceutical R&D, discovery and development of new medicines, he said it's the last truly important organized game for adults. And he said it's endlessly about it, and that's the heart of sort of rational drug design. And so I've been involved in trying to do that for a long time. But I also have a training in toxicology. My first degree was in toxicology, and I was trained by some of the best pioneered the field of sort of mechanisms of toxicity to try and understand sometimes how drugs can produce or environmental toxins can produce injury to people. So I'm attuned to that way of thinking. And so now I've realized that by, instead of these vaccines being wonderful and kind of Star Trek and 21st century, they're actually a regression from the control that you get with old-fashioned vaccine. So traditional vaccine, you would get hold of some of the pathogen and either kill it or chemically degrade it in some way or weaken it so that it can't cause disease. And then you present it to the human body along with what are called adjuvants, things that will wake up the immune system. And then basically that does mimic an see the real pathogen in your life, you'll be able to repel it and hopefully get away with no more than mild symptoms. So, but we're being told that these new classes of vaccines are somehow better. But as I'm just going to describe to you, they're unavoidably flawed. I with this insight, I would never use them for this purpose. I would use them for treating cancers where you can tolerate an unavoidable level of variable biological response, which is what I think is happening here. So when you normally administer, say, a vaccine, you can the people who've made it will know that they're giving you 100 micrograms of degraded influenza virus or whatever. You know the dose you're giving. And then it just disperses around the body from its intramuscular site. And we've been doing this for decades, and so we're reasonably sure now what the safety profile will be of the next influenza season. The pathogen is the same. But having called themselves vaccines, Rainer, as you said, these materials, I'm not going to argue totally that they're nothing like vaccines, because they do ultimately educate the human body to memorize an encounter with part of the pathogen. But the way they do it is so different from classical vaccines, I think it's been a serious category error on the part of the medicines regulators to have said, okay, this is a vaccine, so this is the standard procedures you need to follow for a vaccine. But that is what's happened. And a standard procedure with vaccines, unlike my field of endeavor, so-called small molecule R&D, with vaccines, you do not need to characterize what's called pharmacokinetics, that is the movement of the administered substance around the body, its distribution, its metabolism, its elimination, whether it's retained in the body. It's simply not required. And as you'd expect, the innovators of these genetic code are going. We don't know. So they're not required to study that. And also they're not required to study what's called pharmacodynamics, the actual impact of the material on various biological processes. They're only required to demonstrate an immune response and, you know, some kind of protection against the pathogen. So that's what they've done. And I believe, having not looked at the pharmacokinetics, the movement of the drug around the body, pharmacodynamics, its actual effects in various organs and tissues and cells and so on, then that has allowed some things to happen, which I shall describe, that otherwise would have been found. So I believe that when the vaccine is administered, there will be, as it were, a sort of probabilistic distribution of where it goes. So it might go slightly more in one person to their pulmonary blood vessels, in another person more to their kidney outcomes. And if you think about this, I think there will be some people who get what I call tail risk. They will be in the group that had the greatest concentration of the vaccine in a particular organ as compared with the average. Now, having landed in that tissue, again, there's now a range of outcomes that some cells will take up this vaccine easily and others less well. And again, range of biological outcomes, and some people will be in this tail risk of high efficiency of take-up. And then having taken it up, some cells will manufacture a little bit of spike protein, some will manufacture a lot, some will manufacture copious amounts. And the duration of synthesis will vary, I've no doubt, from a short time to a medium time to a long time. And again, I turn the listener's attention to the concept of tail risk. A person who's got very efficient translation and manifest trigger that we all vary slightly in our susceptibility biological range, like most things. I turn your attention to the tail risk, someone who's very sensitive to blood clots. And so I think that because of the nature, the multiple steps between injection and the end biology, that if you consider people who are the unluckiest and they get, you know, more of the vaccine to a sensitive tissue, perhaps there's already some injury to the inside of the blood vessels. That might do it. And then more efficient uptake than average, more efficient manufacture of spike protein than the average, more efficient or more susceptible to clots than the average. So that's why when people say to me, oh, well, it's been injected into tens of thousands of people and it's been fine, so you're wrong even about the initiation of cerebral vein thromboses. And I've just explained, I think, to anyone who's willing to think about it, that in fact, that's what you would expect. Most people will probably be fine, but I think predictably, some people, and we won't know who they are going to get severe adverse events and mRNA vaccines. And so I think, armed with that information, if I was a medicines regulator, I would encourage classical vaccines that use just whole killed virus, and I would not provide authorization for any further of these, because I don't believe it's possible to get around that problem. So I'm going to pause at that point, because I think a toxicologist's view, as it were, of what has probably happened, I think I can't be certain that's what's happening, but to me it fits the facts, and I've not heard any other explanation. So I'll pause for translation and questions, Rainer.
Okay, thank you. Also er hat darauf hingewiesen, dass er jahrzehntelange Erfahrung mit pharmazeutischer RNA, also Forschung hat. Über 30 Jahre ein Professor Jane Black, der unter anderem die Beta-Blocker entwickelt hat, war einer seiner Lehrer. Er hat aber auch umfangreiches Training in Toxikologie erfahren. Und deswegen weiß er, dass das, was hier als Impfstoff verkauft wird, ja, das ist ja in Wahrheit Zeit kein Impfstoff. Da hat er jetzt mehrfach darauf hingewiesen, es ist kein Impfstoff. Es wird uns weiß gemacht, dass es Impfstoff ist, aber in Wahrheit sind die herkömmlichen Impfstoffe was völlig anderes. Das wird nur als Impfstoff bezeichnet, weil es als Impfstoff benutzt wird. Diese Impfstoffe sind, so sagt er, unavoidably flawed, also unvermeidbar defekt, für den einen mehr, für den anderen weniger. Er sagt, er würde sie niemals zur Bekämpfung dessen, was wir hier haben, nämlich respiratorische Probleme einsetzen, Lungenprobleme einsetzen. Er würde das allenfalls zur Bekämpfung von bestimmten Krebsarten einsetzen, zur Bekämpfung von Krebs, also zur Bekämpfung von Krankheiten, die Menschen schon haben. Hier werden ja Gesunde geimpft, in Anführungsstrichen, mit diesen Nicht-Impfstoffen behandelt. Hier sagt er, gibt es einen schwerwiegenden regulatorischen, aufsichtsbehördlichen Fehler. Das hätte niemals als Impfstoff zugelassen werden dürfen. Dadurch sind bestimmte Dinge, die noch bei normalen Impfstoffen gemacht werden, gar nicht durchgeführt worden, beziehungsweise hat man übersehen, dass hier Dinge passieren, die normale Impfstoffe gar nicht machen. Die Pharmakodynamik, sagt er, ist komplett übersehen worden und das hat dazu geführt, dass Dinge passieren, die sonst erkannt worden wären. Dass hier also die Stoffe, die eingebracht werden in den Körper, ich sage jetzt nicht mehr Impfstoffe, dass die Stoffe, die eingebracht werden, wir haben ja auch schon viel darüber gehört von Professor Schmidt-Krüger, von Dr. Schmidt-Krüger, dass hier die diese Lipide im gesamten Körper sich verbreiten, dass dort also, und darauf spielt er jetzt auch an, dass also in bestimmten Organen ganz viel sich von diesem Zeug ansammelt, in anderen vielleicht weniger. Und das kommt dann auf den Einzelfall an, wie viel von diesen Stoffen in den Körper, in welchen Organen sich anlagern und dort dann Schäden anrichten. Jedenfalls führt es auch zu Blood Clots, also zu wie heißt das auf Deutsch, Gerinnungsstörungen an allen möglichen Ecken. Bei einigen Menschen zu ganz schweren Gerinnungsstörungen und dann eben auch mit Todesfolge. Er sagt, auf gar keinen Fall sollte man das, was immer es ist, was hier behandelt werden muss, es ist jedenfalls wohl ein respiratorisches Problem, deswegen heißt es ja SARS-CoV-2, nämlich Severe Acute Respiratory also Lungenkrankheit, auf gar keinen Fall sollte man diese mRNA-genetischen Experimente als Impfstoffe zulassen, sondern allenfalls zur Behandlung von Krebsarten. Hier sollte man, wenn überhaupt, mit den ganz normalen Impfstoffen arbeiten, die dann auch als solche beobachtet werden, während hier ja Konsequenzen ausgelöst werden, die mit Impfstoffen überhaupt nichts zu tun haben und die genau deshalb, weil man sie als Impfstoffe zulässt, nicht erkannt werden. Er sagt, das sei wohl, ich habe es mir irgendwo hier aufgeschrieben, ein unvermeidbares Ergebnis und er hofft, glaube ich, so hat er es gesagt, dass es sich hier um einen harmlosen oder einen nicht jedenfalls vom Vorsatz gedeckten Fehler handelt, der sich hier ereignet hat mit den vielen Todesfolgen. Okay, yes.
In case this spike protein problem occurs, do you have a time frame for when we would see the largest amount of issues? Is this like just right after the vaccination, or would it also occur like in half a year's time, 2 years, or once, you know, another exposure to the real wild virus is occurring?
So it's a great question. As I just mentioned, because of the medicines regulators guidelines for proper development of quote vaccines, they don't need to study that, and so we don't know is the answer. But I would assume that it will depend on the, as it were, the pace with which the administered material deposits somewhere, is taken up by cells, converted into spike protein, and how much of that is made, and the sensitivity of the of the place where it's occurring. I guess the arm-waving answer is it could be any time, I would suspect, within between a few hours and a couple of weeks, depending on what it is that ultimately happens. So, for example, if somebody did die of a cerebral vein thrombosis, that process might take some time to occur. And I've heard, been reading news reports over the last few days of some people who've had headaches for several days before you finally turn into MS. And there have been some sad cases of young people who are not at risk from the virus succumbing to really unusual thromboembolic disorders that follow vaccination. So whilst, of course, that's not absolute proof, it's when you tie that back to the known biology of spike protein and the design of the vaccines, you know, I think it, beyond reasonable doubt, would be fair in my mind that when you do see a cluster of unusual thromboembolic events and people generally don't suffer them and following vaccination with one of these materials, I think the processes of so-called tail risk times several times, that probably does account for it. But I think it's very important what I'm going to say next. I'm speaking to physicians and vaccinators, you know, anywhere around the world. We traditionally recognize that medical interventions always come with some risks. There's no free lunch, there'll always be some risks. So the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence of problems. I don't think we know enough about short, medium, or long-term consequences of administering this material to a diverse population. And we know this, and what we always do historically is to consider risk-benefit. Is the person at sufficient risk from the thing you're going to treat them for that it's reasonable to assume that a likely set of risks that might come with this intervention? If the answer is yes, you know, that they really are at risk, if they catch the virus, big chance they'll get ill or die. Even I, with the knowledge I've got, if I was that 82-year-old person with two chronic illnesses, I probably would still accept the vaccine. But here's the key point, doctors, administrators of vaccinations, what the hell are you doing encouraging younger, healthy people to take this vaccine when they don't stand a statistically important chance of becoming ill from this virus? You're just being lied to when people tell you that, well, it's for the team. Everybody needs to be vaccinated. They don't. If the everybody else who's younger and not already unwell doesn't need it. But if you administer it, doctors and vaccinators, I'm telling you, you will condemn some people to deaths that were avoidable. And that should be on your conscience the rest of your life now you know this. So, again, to regulators, you should put a restriction on the use of this for people. It should say for people who are prominent, you know, obvious, elevated risk of severe outcomes from SARS-CoV-2, and exclude it being used in other people. And there are always going to be risks with the medical intervention. You just don't know what they are early on, but it's stupid and reckless and ignorant to just assume it'll be fine. You don't know that it'll be fine, so use your Hippocratic Oath, stop vaccinating people who are not at risk from the virus. You do the right thing. So that's what I want to say about vaccines. But pause at this point if you wanted just to wrap that up, because I've got...
Yes, let me interject, Mike, because we have had so many reports from whistleblowers, from nursing homes here in Germany, but also from other countries. We have interviewed some of the whistleblowers, and the reports that are coming in amount to the following. In particular, in the nursing homes, those who are over 80, if they do get these vaccines, shots, many of them succumb to the adverse effects, whatever they are, within 3 weeks, meaning they die. From one of the nursing homes, we've heard that around 20% of the people out of 31 persons who were vaccinated, who didn't have any problems, apart from the, in this case, dementia that they were suffering from, but they all were tested right before they got the vaccine, before they got the shots, and they were all negative. Now, out of 31 people, 8 people died within 3 weeks, and 11 more people are suffering serious side effects. We don't know if they're still alive because we're going to have to get in touch with this whistleblower again. So even if you say regulators should make it clear that this is not, it's not necessary for younger people to get vaccinated, well, this poses a serious risk from what we have learned from these whistleblowers, even to older people as well. So maybe we should think about different ways of protecting the people who are really at risk here.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm very keen that people don't have justification, which I think is not fair, to call me anti-vax. I'm pro-safety, for God's sake. I've spent my entire working life trying to work out how we can intervene in a novel way in diseases where there's unmet need, and then to come up, bring forward an actual medication that can work on that mechanism, hopefully to produce more benefit than harm, and then to push that. I've lived to do, and although I didn't work in vaccine personally, good ones, you know, are definitely a really important innovation. So I'm not against vaccines. I'm not even 100% against, you know, classically designed vaccines. But I'm very concerned about these by virtue of the way they are designed and work. And as Ryan has said, some of the serious adverse events. So if anyone still wants to call me anti-vax, well, you're just stupid. I am pro-safety.
Uh-huh. I'll translate this, Mike. Also, yeah. Er weist nochmal darauf hin, er hat sein ganzes Leben lang, er war immer für die Sicherheit, pro-safety, hat er eben nochmal erklärt. Er war noch nie gegen Impfungen, aber nur, er ist nur für sichere Impfungen, für solche Impfungen, die wirklich Sinn machen. Von diesem Standpunkt aus kommt er. Und da sagt er, das, was hier passiert, das sind keine Impfungen. Und das sollten die Regulators, also die Behörden, die hier insbesondere die EMA, die der EU-Kommission empfohlen hat, ich persönlich vermute, das war eine Auftragsempfehlung, weil wir ja inzwischen wissen, dass da ganz andere Dinge im Hintergrund laufen. Er sagt, auf jeden Fall müssten diese Regulators in der Lage sein zu erklären, dass diese Impfungen für gesunde, jüngere Personen völlig unnötig sind, weil sie für diese gesunden, jüngeren Personen ein wahnsinniges Risiko darstellen. Er hat jetzt einige Beispiele beschrieben von Menschen, die nach der Impfung, jüngere Menschen, die nach der Impfung plötzlich unerklärbare Symptome aufwiesen, Kopfschmerzen bekommen haben, wahrscheinlich wegen Blutgerinnseln, die bis ins Gehirn vorgedrungen sind und die dann gestorben sind. Also auf keinen Fall, so sagt er, dürfen die Regulatoren, die Behörden das für jüngere Menschen, die nicht zu der gefährdeten Gruppe gehören, zulassen. Ich habe dann eingeworfen, dass wir ja Informationen von auch Altersheimen haben, also von Pflegern aus Altersheimen, von auch jetzt von Krankenschwestern, die sich auf Corona-Stationen, die das einfach nicht mehr ausgehalten haben. Wir haben Informationen darüber erhalten, dass die älteren Menschen gerade, nachdem sie geimpft worden sind, zu einem gehörigen Prozentsatz verstorben sind. Menschen, die vorher negativ getestet worden sind. Wir haben ja das Whistleblower-Video bei uns auf der Website, ist es ja sichtbar, dass da von 31 geimpften Menschen 8 innerhalb von 3 Wochen verstorben sind und 11, müssen wir nochmal nachhaken, was aus denen geworden ist, jedenfalls mit schweren Nebenwirkungen zu kämpfen haben. Er sagt, ja, da stimmt er sofort zu. Er sagt nur, ganz sicher ist es jedenfalls, und dass man also über andere Maßnahmen zum Schutz dieser sogenannten Risikogruppen nachdenken muss, als über diese Impfung. Sagt er, stimmt er sofort zu, aber fest steht aus seiner Sicht, die Jüngeren dürften auf gar keinen Fall geimpft werden. Die jüngeren Menschen, sagt er, weist er mehrfach darauf hin, die werden belogen. Die werden belogen, wenn sie sich impfen lassen, weil sie nicht darüber aufgeklärt werden, welche Konsequenzen das alles haben kann. Auch und gerade für jüngere Menschen auf die Frage von Viviane, wann sich das alles rausstellen kann, sagt er, bei manchen sofort, bei manchen ein bisschen später und bei manchen eben sehr viel später. Das sind die sogenannten Tail Risks, über die er gesprochen hat. Die Nebenwirkungen, die langfristig, mittelfristig zu erwarten sind. Und er sagt, wer ihn als Anti-Vaccine bezeichnet, der ist einfach zu dumm, zu verstehen, wo er herkommt. Er weist immer wieder darauf hin, er ist für Sicherheit, für Safety, er ist kein Anti-Vaccine-Mann, sondern er sagt nur, hier geht es ja gar nicht um Impfstoffe, hier geht es um ja, medizinische Experimente, die man vielleicht mit krebskranken Menschen ausführen kann, wenn keine andere Möglichkeit besteht, aber nicht mit Menschen, die gesund sind und die nicht zur Risikogruppe gehört. Da hat er jetzt so oft vorgewarnt, das müssen die Regulators ernst nehmen. Okay, I got that, Mike. We're all very grateful for you to take a stand and warn that this is going to have catastrophic consequences, which we have already seen, which we are witnessing right now. We're going to talk to a Holocaust survivor. She's waiting in line, and I think she shares your warnings against what is going on. These are not vaccines. These are medical experiments. These are genetic experiments, as we have all seen. This should not happen because it should, as a result of the Nuremberg trials, the Helsinki Code, which has been adopted by most civilized countries into their own legal systems, this should not even be able to happen, but it is happening. So that's why I'm extremely great. We're all extremely grateful for you to take this stand and be so outspoken to warn about these things and to warn that the regulatory systems shouldn't allow this to happen, at least not to be administered to younger people.
Yes, absolutely. So, Rainer, you probably have, you know, another speaker, and so if I could just speak for 1 minute, and then maybe we could schedule. I think it'd be good if I scheduled a time soon to come back and describe another very, very worrying development. So I'll just summarize it, and then I could work with Corbyn and maybe set up a time to come and speak to you rather than displacing. So just in brief, mm-hmm. You will no doubt be aware that there's sort of much propaganda, in my view, is being made over the subject of variants, virus mm-hmm. variants. I think the notion is being put about that these are, you know, dangerous in some way, and that we need to keep them out of country, let's close borders and put in place quarantine hotels. But this is all not true. The immunology of variants is such that they constitute less than 0.3% change in the sequence of the virus protein. And I can assure you, there's no way in the world anyone's body is going to be fooled into thinking any of these variants are a new pathogen, which is what they have to think if this idea of immune escape that's being talked about were to occur. But that's what's being drummed into all of us through the world's media, and it's not true. But here's the thing I'm terrified about. On the back of this purported risk from variants, the pharmaceutical industry right now is designing top-up vaccines that will provide, you know, recipients with immune protection against these nasty variants. Now, they've had conversations with the medical regulators, and they've talked to each other, like the European Medicines Agency, FDA, and so on. And those regulators have agreed in principle. I don't know if it's been formally minuted yet, but they've agreed in principle that since these top-up vaccines are so similar to the original vaccines, they, the medical regulators, will not require the drug companies to clinical trials on them. And they claim an analogy with the annual seasonal influenza vaccine, but which is not analogous at all. But again, you can see by adopting the clothes of a more benign vaccine, they're managing to wriggle under the wire. So I'm saying In contrast to Geert Land and Bosch, which have a difference of view. So if I'm right, and most of the immunologists say I'm right, the degree of difference between the variants and the original virus are so small as to not possibly be represent a problem in terms of not recognizing it. So therefore, there's no need for top-up vaccines, and yet they are being made. And because they claim to be analogous to the leading agents, they will not need to go through normal regulatory clinical trials. And so I just simply leave it right now. And I'll happily come back and talk about, you know, why I'm worried. But I think alert people will now realize that private corporations have the opportunity to go from a whiteboard of some genetic sequence straight into the arms of people without passing through any normal regulatory scrutiny. So it's not my crime, as I say to people, I'm not the criminal. But if I was the criminal, and if my motives do something very harmful to a very large number of people with plausible deniability, I couldn't really think of a better way of doing it. So I would caution responsible regulators and physicians and just intelligent members of the community to challenge like hell to show the immunological claim that they're making, that they represent a risk, because they're doing all sorts of contrived experiments with antibodies and artificial virus and receptor binding systems and showing, oh, look, it doesn't block as well. It's just irrelevant. It's the cytotoxic T lymphocytes that protect you mostly. And empirical work has been done and shows that anyone who's been infected with SARS-CoV-2 has an entirely effective complement of cytotoxic T lymphocytes that recognize all of the variants that have so far been tested. So believe me, yet they're being claiming an analogy with flu vaccines, so they don't have to go through proper clinical trials. And so I just leave it to people's imagination, because it's not my crime, but I'm very much worried that this is being used for to produce great harm, and we'll just walk straight into it. So that's all I wanted to say today, but I happily come back and expand on this with detail and references on another occasion, Ryan.
Absolutely. Let us do that, Mike. I realize that this is extremely important, because this development is even more dangerous than what we've been seeing up until here, because this is something that's going on, so to speak, under the radar with absolutely no clinical trials whatsoever. And what worries me about this is that all of a sudden they're trying to draw analogies with the flu. Vaccines, whereas up until here, the flu didn't really compare, at least in their view, because this is something completely different from the flu. So we're gonna have to look into this. It is extremely worrying, this development. I can see that. Let us schedule with Corvin's help. Let us schedule another interview.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. Bye-bye. Okay. Have a great weekend, despite all this.
Okay.
We'll talk. We'll meet again. I'm going to translate this. Also sagt, jetzt kommt eine neue Gefahr, denn diese sogenannten Mutanten, die Variants, die jetzt plötzlich aus der Tüte gezogen werden, um uns noch mehr in Panik zu versetzen, um uns zu verstehen zu geben, dass die ja noch viel schwieriger sind und noch gefährlicher sind, sagt er, die unterscheiden sich überhaupt nicht, 0,3% oder sowas von dem, was wir vorher gesehen haben, so wie immer, wenn es Mutationen gibt. Das sei alles falsch, was uns da erzählt wird. Das normale Immunsystem lässt sich überhaupt nicht täuschen. Diese Mutationen werden genauso erkannt wie das, was wir vorher schon gesehen haben. Er weist nochmal darauf hin, dass es da erst recht keinen Grund gibt, jetzt zusätzliche Impfungen durchzuführen mit zusätzlichen Impfstoffen, Top-Up-Vaccines, sagt er, weil das ist ja noch gefährlicher, was jetzt mit zusätzlichen Impfstoffen passiert, weil jetzt wird plötzlich behauptet, ach, das ist so ähnlich wie bei der normalen Grippe, da braucht man ja auch keine klinischen Versuche mehr für die weiteren Impfstoffe, wenn man einmal einen Impfstoff getestet hat, jetzt muss man nicht mehr testen, das heißt, es fliegt unter dem Radar lang, es gibt überhaupt keine Tests mehr für das, was jetzt als Top-Up-Vaccines, als zusätzliche zusätzliche Impfungen angeblich benötigt wird. Unser körpereigenes Immunsystem, da hat er jetzt mehrfach darauf hingewiesen, auch schon bei dem ersten Interview mit ihm, unser körpereigenes Immunsystem erkennt das. Und wenn hier jemand schon mal dem SARS-CoV-2 oder dem Coronavirus begegnet ist, der Körper schon mal begegnet ist, dann haben wir sowieso schon längst Immunität, auch gegen diese Mutationen, die jetzt da sind. Er warnt nochmal ganz dringend davor, dass wir hier keine zusätzlichen Impfstoffe, in Anführungsstrichen Impfstoffe, einsetzen sollten. Schon gar nicht Impfstoffe, die, wie jetzt behauptet wird, noch nicht mal mehr getestet werden müssten. Also größte Sorge auf seiner Seite, nicht nur vor dem, was jetzt gerade läuft. Das sind keine Impfstoffe, die sind hochgefährlich, sagt er, insbesondere für die Jüngere, für den jüngeren Teil der Gesellschaft, der sowieso nicht gefährdet ist. Wir sind uns darüber einig, als ich ihn darauf angesprochen habe, dass wir hier von den Altenheimen und von anderen Whistleblowern Informationen darüber bekommen haben, dass die Alten auch gefährdet sind. Sagt er auch, klar, wenn das anders möglich ist, soll man anders schützen, auf jeden Fall nicht mit diesen Impfstoffen. Wenn überhaupt, dann die normalen Impfstoffe. Allerdings glauben wir, dass hier überhaupt keine erforderlich sind. Tja, ob sich die Behörden davon beeindrucken lassen, werden wir sehen. Dr. Mike Yeadon hat ja auch mit Dr. Wodak die europäische Behörde angeschrieben und vor all dem schon gewarnt. Er macht es jetzt nochmal öffentlich und er wird auch nochmal zurückkommen, damit wir auch diese weitere große Gefahr, die er jetzt hier sieht, also Top-up, also zusätzliche Impfungen, die keine sind, wegen der Mutation, damit wir das nochmal genauer besprechen können.